Mr. Brooks?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Marcus Brooks. I represent the Regas's taxpayers and appellants in this matter. This court should reverse the granting of summary judgment in favor of the government and render a judgment in favor of the taxpayers. To affirm the granting of the summary judgment would approve of the IRS's violations of a number of important statutory provisions and indeed the basic objective of a subchapter in the Internal Revenue Code relating to the tax treatment of partnership items. Sections 6221 to 34 of the code are generally referred to as the TEFRA provisions. They establish the principle, which was, these statutes, by the way, were requested in part by the Internal Revenue Service, so that administration of tax, of partnership tax items, would be eased by providing for an administration at the partnership level as opposed to administration at the individual partner level. Partnerships generally are not tax-paying entities. Partnerships are tax-reporting entities. They file a partnership tax return, which is a Form 1065, reporting the amount of income, loss, deductions, tax credits, whatever, of the partnership, and they issue to all the individual partners Schedules K-1. The individual partners then take those Schedules K-1 and report on their own tax return their share of the partnership income, partnership loss, and pay taxes based upon that amount. Prior to TEFRA, every individual partner, that was administered at the individual partner level. After TEFRA, under 6221, partnership items are determined at the partnership level unless there are some exceptions. Under Section 6222, partners are required to report their income on their return consistently with the partnership return unless they elect inconsistent treatment and pursue a different path. That never happened here. This case presents a unique fact pattern that you will not find in any other case addressing TEFRA. In this case, the tax matters partner for the partnership, Odyssey, filed an amended partnership tax return and related information requesting an adjustment of an item of income at the partnership level. That item of income was income earned by Odyssey in its business relationship with Hydrocarbon. The request was that that item of income be adjusted from ordinary income to capital gains. That adjustment was made. The partnership also issued amended Schedules K-1 to each of the partners, who filed 1040Xs on each of their individual behalves so that their individual reporting would be consistent with that of the partnership. It is not actually required that they do so. Under Section 6230D5 of the code, if a partnership level adjustment request is made and would result in a refund, then the IRS is supposed to go ahead and pay the individual partners where practicable. The Internal Revenue Manual says the same thing. Often, however, partners file a 1040X anyway to make sure that their individual reporting is in line with the partnership. The Regas 1040X was actually pulled and acted upon before the partnership return was acted upon. The Regas' CPA, Jeff Wilkinson, who guided them through this process, had a couple of back and forths with IRS personnel, was very open and helpful with them, gave them the information that they needed, and the Regas' first claim was disallowed. The notice of disallowance said, we are disallowing this claim because the partnership item has not been adjusted at the partnership level. You should refile this after the partnership return is adjusted. Shortly thereafter, the partnership return was adjusted. We have a file stretching from August of 2007 to February of 2008. It has initials and signatures from at least 13 IRS employees. It includes in it a TEFRA relationship graph generated by the IRS, which shows the partnership, the identity of all the partners, the amounts of income that would be affected for each of those partners based on the adjustment. The file includes a chart generated by Jeff Wilkinson and given to the IRS, which shows the relationship between Hydrocarbon and Odyssey. The file includes a two-page bullet point narrative explanation prepared by the CPA, Jeff Wilkinson, explaining why the partnership income should be adjusted to capital gain. That file ultimately concludes with a Form 5344, an examination closing record, which in several respects detailed in our brief shows an examination was done, the adjustment at the partnership level was made. That file also includes a Form 4605, examination changes for partnerships, which also shows unequivocally the adjustment from ordinary income to capital gain was made. Two IRS employees who later reviewed the file in connection with the second Regas filing, we'll get to in a second, looked back and in internal correspondence said, Odyssey was audited, the adjustment was made. Only in litigation has the IRS said, oh no, that didn't happen. Don't look at the man behind the curtain, the adjustment wasn't made. There's absolutely no evidence supporting that assertion. There's voluminous evidence, both documentary and testimonial. We have testimony from a senior IRS level examiner, Ms. Swain, who made the adjustment. Ms. Swain stated several times plainly the adjustment was made. The fact that the IRS now wishes it hadn't made that adjustment does not mean that that adjustment was not made. The Regas is then refiled pursuant to the IRS's original instructions. After the partnership return is adjusted, refile this claim. They did. All four other partners now have been paid and the partnership item has been adjusted. The Regases were not paid, even after the partnership was adjusted and after they followed the IRS's instructions. Instead, a new examiner grabbed the Regas's file and just did an audit of a partnership-level item through the Regas's. Now, that violates a number of important TEFRA provisions. He didn't give notice to the tax matters partner. He did not provide the other partners an opportunity to participate. The statute of limitations for adjusting the partnership item had run. In the Odyssey file, the IRS acknowledged that statute of limitations under 6229 ran on April 15, 2008. Because TEFRA barred any further changes to this return, he instead determined to do an in-run around TEFRA. We'll just circumvent this subchapter, deny the Regas's claim, even though the adjustment was made at the Odyssey level, and recommend that the other partners be sued. Ultimately, what happened is two partners were paid and keep their refunds no matter what. Two partners were paid and have been sued for the return of their refunds in a case pending in the Southern District of Texas, and Regas is here in this pending litigation. Now, the IRS never had to do anything with the original partnership request for an adjustment. One of their options under 6227C2 is to do nothing and force the partnership to file a lawsuit if it wants to press the issue. That's not what they did. They made the adjustment, and the fact that they wish they hadn't doesn't make it not so. The Regases are entitled to the partnership level treatment under TEFRA. Now, the IRS has got two basic responses to this mess. I don't think anybody would argue it's not a mess, but they have two basic responses. One is, it's the taxpayer's fault. The second is, so what, you have no recourse. As to the first one, it's the taxpayer's fault. The IRS wishes to rely on the absence of a Form 8082 with the original partnership return and then with the Regas 1040-Fs. You will search the statute in vain for the words Form 8082. You will search the regulations in vain for the words Form 8082. There is a reference in the regulations to a form promulgated by the IRS. If you dig enough, you can find that is a Form 8082. The Internal Revenue Manual tells the Internal Revenue Service examiners if a partnership return, an amended partnership return, is filed without an 8082, it is considered to be a non-substituted AAR, and it should be processed as such. The Internal Revenue Manual also tells examiners, if you need an 8082, if you think there's some information you don't have, ask for one. In fact, not just ask for one, send one to the taxpayer, ask them to finish completing it, and send it back to you. Both of the examiners in this case, the Odyssey level examiner and the Regas level examiner, testified they had everything they needed to do their job, that they did not need an 8082, and that an 8082 would have made no difference to them. In fact, and further, the IRS took action on both of these files. They adjusted the partnership income. They disallowed the Regases. That's a waiver of any alleged procedural defects. That's in our briefing that's in a supplemental record excerpt in the summary judgment briefing. The district court found substantial compliance with the Regas's filing. The government never filed a notice of cross appeal and so should not be heard here to say there was no substantial compliance. Further, the Regas has actually filed 8082s as required before their claim was finally disallowed, which the government has never answered. In light of the facts of this case and the testimony of those examiners, the government's 8082 arguments are not only pedantic and meritless, they're really borderline not in good faith, because the people on the ground said we had everything we needed, and when we asked Mr. Wilkinson for something, he gave it to us. The second argument is, TEFRA wasn't followed, but you have no recourse. TEFRA is clearly not meant to be a one-way street that runs only at taxpayers. Section 6224 of TEFRA says that if a taxpayer gets a settlement with the IRS with respect to a partnership item, that settlement offer is provided to all partners. Here, the Reguses were disallowed. Then the partnership was later adjusted. The other partners were paid. The Reguses should have got the same treatment. 6230C provides for refund claims and suits by a partner with respect to computational errors relating to computational adjustments. 6231A6 defines a computational adjustment as a change in tax liability of a partner which reflects treatment of a partnership item. That sounds a whole lot like what this is. What the IRS has said is we made no computation at all, so we can't have made a computational error, meaning we didn't even attempt to reflect the partnership level treatment at the partner level, i.e. we so fundamentally violated this statute that we didn't make an error in computation, we just made no computation. I think we could debate whether no computation when one is required is an error, but in any event, what this shows is the bedrock assumption that a partner gets the treatment of the partnership after an adjustment is made. If this court does not enforce TEFRA's provisions for consistency in favor of taxpayers, TEFRA has become something that its plain language and its legislative history refute, and that is a weapon to be used against taxpayers. When it's the IRS's preference, they will follow TEFRA. When it's not, they'll do an end run around it, and it will result in maybe the raising of more revenue, but certainly a violation of taxpayer rights that are plain on the face of TEFRA. Moving to the substantive case, briefly, I'm running myself out of time. In Culbertson and Tower, the Supreme Court's made clear whether parties are in a joint venture depends on whether they intended to join together in the conduct of a business enterprise, combination of money, know-how, services, and a community of interest in the business profits. That's quintessentially what we have here. Under the district court's analysis, Odyssey contributed millions of dollars to this venture, was paid in net profits. The district court was distracted by the fact that a lot of that capital, not all of it, some of that capital came directly out of Odyssey's pockets. A lot of it came from a note with Hydrocarbon, the partner. That note has a non-recourse provision in it. What that ignores is, one, the note was repaid with interest. Two, amounts were paid by Odyssey that weren't pulled down through the note. And three, there was a side letter agreement that encumbered all of Odyssey's assets, everything Odyssey owned, some of which came from other ventures and partner contributions, which were encumbered to pay the note, Hydrocarbon's initial investment back to Hydrocarbon, the preferred return to Hydrocarbon, and any Hydrocarbon expenses, which, by the way, the preferred return and the initial investment are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. That's really what they'd have been worried about, far in excess of this note. Those assets were actually called upon after the end of this venture. There was a clawback call from Hydrocarbon to Odyssey, which was paid by Odyssey out of its general assets, which included some assets from this venture and some assets from other places. The other thing that the court, that distracted the court and that the government has primarily relied upon in briefing is a no partnership provision in the agreement between Hydrocarbon and Odyssey. The government has cited to the Danielson line of cases saying you can't rewrite an agreement for tax purposes. I would point this court to a State of Crafts 608 F. 2nd 240, affirming 68 TC 249, a tax court opinion that discusses this at length. What those cases say, property rights are created at the state law level. The taxation of those rights is determined at the federal level. We're not going to look behind an agreement at the state law level to redetermine property rights if evidence would be inadmissible in an action in state court. Well, here we're talking about characterization of income, which is quintessentially a federal tax issue. It's not the state law property rights. It's not what do you have. It's how do we characterize it. Danielson and its line of cases are inapplicable to characterization of income cases. Further, in Texas, and I'll point the court to one case, Valero Energy versus Tico Pipeline, 2 Southwest 3rd 576. In Texas, in an action between parties to determine whether their written agreement is a partnership, extrinsic evidence is admissible. In fact, the court collected cases and said that a statement in a written agreement as to whether something is or is not a partnership is a legal conclusion that is not determinative, and the court must look at other evidence of the party's relationship. So under the plain terms of Danielson, here, even with respect to an action between the parties, evidence of their relationship and actions is admissible. Burden of proof here is on the government. We believe the court should have rendered, this court should reverse and render in favor of the taxpayers on the substantive issue as well as a procedural issue. In any event, with the burden of proof being on the government, they clearly have not met that burden here with evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Thank you, counsel. You've reserved time for rebuttal. Ms. Hauser.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Bethany Hauser for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. This is a very unusual case for the Commissioner because the District Court reached the merits and ruled for the Commissioner on summary judgment, and we believe that that ruling was correct for the reasons the District Court gave. The only, we think, as we explained in our briefs, that the District Court, that the legal landscape is actually slightly more favorable to the government in that the contract between the parties was entitled to very significant weight, especially because especially the commissioner was entitled to rely upon it because the commissioner was not a party to the contract, unlike in a suit between private parties, both of whom signed the contract. What's unusual about this case is we think that the district court should not have reached the merits because there was no partner level AAR, which would be a prerequisite to a suit under 6228B. The district court found that there was, that the taxpayer's 1040X was in substantial compliance with the requirements for a partner AAR. There are cases holding that the doctrine of substantial compliance applies to partner level to forms 1040X. However, those cases involve forms 1040X that did provide the IRS with all the information required in a partner-level AAR. Here, the district court even has a paragraph listing the requirements of a form 10 of a partner AAR that were not provided here. Most significantly, this 1040X filed by the taxpayers here gave no indication that they were asking for a change at the partnership level. It just indicated that they were trying to conform their return to something already done at the partnership level. So the IRS, on receiving it, would not have believed there was any reason to start an investigation. Now, we suggested in the brief that perhaps the district court judge was could have used the doctrine of administrative waiver instead of the doctrine of substantial compliance. There wouldn't be any difference in the outcome of this case, but obviously the difference would be that the IRS would not be expected to be reading taxpayers' minds in the next case where a Form 1040X like this comes in, but it would give everybody credit for what happened here, which was that the IRS examiner ultimately reached the merits. Now, that's what I think that may have been what was really driving the district court's decision, and there are administrative waiver cases and ordinary refund cases that look at whether a to the fairness of allowing the IRS to look at the merits of an issue and then back off and defend on procedural grounds. As we explained on our brief, however, we don't think that that doctrine should be expanded to the TEFRA proceeding because in this particular case, the IRS did not obtain the cooperation from the taxpayer and obtain that information and begin to look at the entire relationship between the partnership and the partners until after certain TEFRA statutes of limitation had passed. And so applying that doctrine here would necessarily leave the different partners out of step one with another under TEFRA. The other reason that we are reluctant to argue for that application of that doctrine here is that the government doesn't argue for application of that doctrine. It's taxpayers who do, and the taxpayers here seem to not want to invoke it. And we're reluctant to invoke it offensively to reach an issue that the taxpayers appear not to want to reach. What taxpayers do want to reach here is the issue whether there was a partnership level adjustment. The district court did not address this issue at all because it felt that once the taxpayers had filed suit under 6228B, which is the grounds they used in their initial complaint to the district court, that severed the items from being partnership items. We think that analysis is probably correct. because 6228B specifically states that once the suit is filed, the items, partnership level items, are transformed into partner level items. However, taxpayers are now taking, with respect to the argument that there was a partnership level adjustment, TEFRA specifically states that items, partnership items, can only be adjusted from the reporting on the original return in compliance with the steps of TEFRA. There has to be a partnership proceeding, an FPA, or a partnership level AAR. The form that the partnership filed here, an amended partnership return, is not a meaningful thing under TEFRA. And in fact, that form itself says that if you have a TEFRA partnership, you should not file that form. You should file form 8082. So you don't need to search the regulations and you don't need to search the statutes. You just need to read the form that you are filing, in this case that you, a tax professional, are filing, and see that it instructs you to file a form 8082. It also instructs that the form be filed in certain locations, and it requests information about why the partnership level change is being made. None of those things were provided in the amended partnership return. And for that reason, the IRS employee who processed that return did not even recognize that it was a TEFRA issue, that it was a TEFRA partnership, and simply processed the return by putting its information into the computer. Now, in a non-TEFRA partnership, that decision, the decision to enter the information into the computer instead of starting an examination, would have no final consequence because the partnership itself is not subject to tax. And so the consequences would be to the individual partners, and those partners would be subject to examination on their own returns. If a refund was issued, it would be subject to a wrongful refund suit. In other words, there's no final decision by the commissioner about the merits of the claim in entering a non-TEFRA partnership amended return into the computer. And we don't think it makes any sense to view that action as having been a TEFRA action, because under TEFRA, the IRS is required to communicate all of these decisions to the various partners. And here, this was an entirely internal action that was not known about by the taxpayers until they brought this refund suit. So, in other words, it would create this situation where TEFRA partnerships could file refund suits and then seek the basis in discovery based on administrative actions that weren't understood to be TEFRA actions at the time. We think that would be problematic for the administration under TEFRA going forward. And most importantly, we think that there is no ground for a consistent treatment suit here, because there was no decision that the other partners were entitled to a refund and no decision to settle an open partnership proceeding, because no partnership proceeding was ever opened by issuing them refunds. It's well established that the IRS can issue refunds without making a judgment on the merits. It does that as a matter of administrative course day in and day out, and the Supreme Court case we cited in our briefs for this point, I believe, dates to the 1930s. It is well established in the way the IRS operates that it can issue refunds without having made a statement of what its view of the merits is, and without being held to whatever the issuance of the refund might mean for the merits. Here, there is no settlement agreement to which the taxpayers might seek a consistent settlement. There's no written agreement, there's no signed agreement, and the refunds that were issued don't carry the weight of an agreement. So if the taxpayers can may have brought a consistent treatment plan, claim here, they cannot, there's no settlement or treatment to which they can hold themselves out as being consistent. And that's illustrated here by the fact that the government has filed wrongful refund claims against the two of the partners who were not time limited. The other two partners, the claims the government didn't realize in time the error. And so those were not brought simply because of the statute of limitations. If the panel has no questions, the government will rest on its briefs.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Quickly, the government started by pointing out Danielson. Again, this is a characterization of income case, not what whose property rights were. In Texas law, evidence of the relationship, the substance of it, extrinsic evidence, is admissible even in an action between the parties to determine whether they have a partnership. That is clear. The government argues, as we expected, that the lack of an 8082 means none of this happened or had any import. They said, in fact, there was no partner-level AAR. That ignores, of course, the points that a partnership, an amended partnership return without an 8082, they are told to treat it as an AAR. That ignores this is not a statutory requirement. This is not even in the regulations. They've argued that there are no basis for applying substantial compliance, waiver, perfection, all of these doctrines that are well established in the case law in TEFRA. There is no basis for that. There are, in fact, cases applying those within TEFRA. And some have been cited to the court in our briefing. The underlying rationale for those can be seen in Angelus Mining and its progeny. The IRS can't waive a requirement that's in a statute, but if something is not, if something is procedural and directive in nature in a regulation and doesn't go to the essence of a thing to be done, but just how it's done, it can be waived, it can be substantially complied with. Waiver, substantial compliance, and perfection all apply here. And in fact, substantial compliance, again, was found by the district court and not even appealed. As far as cooperation, I would point the court to the record. Our supplemental brief that makes the summary judgment briefing easier to read is has these as exhibits. The bullet point explanation, 2 pages of narrative from the taxpayer CPA explaining this transaction was in both the Odyssey file that was finalized with the examination closing report and the examination changes, and was in the file for the Reguses. Both auditors at each level had access to a fulsome explanation of this transaction that was put together by the taxpayer's CPA. The idea that they did not have what they need is unsupported. In fact, again, the auditors both testified they had whatever they needed. We heard a few assertions here that they didn't know it was a TEFRA item. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that they didn't know it was a TEFRA item. The first time that has come up was at this podium. In fact, Mr. Glass testified that he knew it was a partnership item and knew what TEFRA was and how it worked. Both examiners testified they had absolutely everything they needed and did their job and finalized it. The fact that the IRS wishes that adjustment had not been made, wishes that partnership level proceeding resulting in it had not taken place, does not mean it didn't happen. Cited a case from the claims court, DeRochamon, talks about how taxpayers must cut square corners when dealing with the government. The IRS also, though, has to walk around the same block. What we have here is a situation where the IRS wants to hold taxpayers to things that are not in the statute, not even in the regulation, chasing things throughout internal IRS pronouncements, but the IRS believes that it itself should not have to follow the statutes that are passed by Congress. The last point we heard a little bit on, you know, was the argument that, well, there's no recourse for the taxpayers. There was no settlement here. Settlement is not defined in TEFRA. Settlement is generally understood, and we've cited Black's Law Dictionary as the resolution of a controversy. That clearly happened here for everyone but the Reguses. Again, 6230 subsection C is on point. It's clear that Congress wanted TEFRA to be enforceable for taxpayers. The IRS, really their best argument as to there being no remedy, one, it would assume there's no settlement, which I think is incorrect. Two, it would have to assume that a computation, that no computation is not a computational error. And even at that point, their argument is essentially, We violated TEFRA in such a basic, fundamental fashion that all the remedies that have been written into it in favor of taxpayers don't apply. We somehow circumvented them by getting underneath all of that, by not giving a partner an adjustment made at the partnership level. That cannot be the law. It's not the intent of TEFRA. It's not the letter of TEFRA. This court should enforce TEFRA and reverse and render for the taxpayers. I've got 30 seconds left. Any questions?
Thank you, counsel. We have your argument. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cool.